Welcome to the Waterstones podcast. I'm Will Rycroft, and earlier this year in our other series, I spoke to Sam Jordison and Eloise Miller, co-directors of Galley Beggar Press, an indie publisher that consistently punches above its weight. When they embraced the challenge of publishing Emma McBride's A Girl is a Half-Formed Thing in 2013, it went on to win the Goldsmiths Prize, the Women's Prize, and the Desmond Elliott Award. 6 years later, they rose to another challenge, not just literary, but entirely practical, as they published a 1,000-plus page single-sentence novel by Lucy Ellman. But risk has its rewards, and it went on to win the Goldsmiths Prize, the James Tate Black Prize, and a place on the Booker Prize shortlist. This is how we made Ducks Newburyport. If you haven't read Ducks, then there's a chance that you know of it as that gigantic novel that's all one sentence. And in this episode, we're going to find out how you print a book like that, how you narrate its audiobook, and how you sell it to a casual book browser. But to begin with, of course, I wanted to know how you write such an expansive book, featuring the stream of consciousness of an Ohio housewife and a mountain lion. So the first voice we hear is that of author Lucy Ellman.
I usually can't start another book until the last one's published. And the last one was published in 2013. But I think I'd already begun notes towards this one before that. And it was really not finished till 2019 completely. So I guess that was 7 years. There were things that occurred to me needed to be said about America, I guess, mainly, that where I came from. And I always sort of thought I might go back, but that's become more and more unbelievable as it's become more uninhabitable. So this is sort of a farewell to that whole idea for me. But anyway, that was one thing that I had to deal with, I thought. The gun culture, for instance. But there was also this animal element that I wanted to get in, because I think it's very weird how we ignore animals almost totally. And we think they're intruders when they just wander around. And there was a case of a mountain lion in Palo Alto in California that I heard about by chance. I mean, there are lots of these. And it was too near a school, people thought. So they were all freaked out. And I don't know what exactly happened that time. I mean, they sometimes shoot them, or they shoot them with a tranquilizer dart and get rid of them that way. Right now, there's this troop of elephants going around China, and everyone keeps saying, where are they going? Why are they going there? And as if we have a right to ask this, when we've simply marauded over the entire planet, ruined everything, and we need to back off as a species and really give them a little breathing space. So that was one thing I thought was urgent. But I also, it's not easy to write what an animal thinks. It's much easier to try to figure out what a human might think. So I also think it can be pretty tedious, maybe, to watch someone struggling to think about what an animal thinks for too long. So I kept that quite condensed, the lioness story, and let the human maraud across the rest of the book. And then I knew the form, and I was off. But there still needed to be a lot of reworking and shaping of the thing. It was a big sculptural effort, and it was also a computer effort, and I've never written on a computer before, but without a computer, I couldn't have done it. And even with one, I think my brain is ruined.
So wait, this book was the first one that you'd ever actually written on a computer. Previously, you had used a typewriter?
Yeah, because I really like having it on paper as soon as I write it. I hate the way you have to wait to print stuff out. Mm. I also don't like the way computers ask you if you want to save your work. Of course you want to save your stupid work. How rude. So, and I'm always scared of losing it. I'm absolutely obsessed with saving it and on the sticks and stuff. And once I didn't do that, and I went off to this little teaching job I had, and I was supposed to meet someone afterwards, and I had to tell her, I got to go immediately because I didn't get my stuff on a stick today. And I don't know if she ever forgave me or understood. I was sick with fear. And I mean, when this thing grows and grows out of all proportion and you're responsible for it, all alone with it for 7 years, because I don't share my stuff with people till the end. So there, it was a big responsibility.
Yeah. What, so do you not share? You don't share with anybody at all? Or do you have sort of close confidants?
I can't talk about it or show it until it's done, as well done as I could make it. And then I have this excellent in-house editor, my husband, Todd McEwen, who's also a writer. And he's essential. Yeah. But he didn't know what I was doing for 7 years. He just had to trust. I did come out to eat and watch movies. He really didn't know. And in fact, I was very secretive about it. And I was surprised that I'd been so successful at the end. He had no idea I was thinking about mountain lions or anything else. I don't think I discarded much, actually. I think I wanted just this huge thing to happen. And the more, the merrier. And I also wanted to get in every single thing I knew about America or I could think of. I just kept going, and I didn't even know how long it was until I'd finished it. And then I was quite attached to it by then. And I looked, and then it turned out when I printed it all up to be enormous.
Which rather begs the question, how did you know when it was finished?
It's not. I actually, it became such a habit to add and add and add to this. When it was done, the final edit with Gally Becker, and I knew I couldn't work on it any further. It was like breaking a habit. I had to stop myself thinking, I must do, no. And it's taken about a year to really get over that. But I don't think about it anymore now.
With the manuscript complete, there came the job of publication. But Bloomsbury, who had published Elman previously, balked at the project. So what happened next? Lucy continues the story before it's taken on by Sam and Ellie at Gally Becker Press.
I was sorry that Bloomsbury didn't want it at first. And I was surprised because they'd been publishing me for many years. So that was a little shock, but my agent, David Godwin, is rather unflappable, and he went straight off, and it seemed very fast.
It came through Lucy's agent, David Godwin, who we had a good relationship with, and he knew the kind of thing we were looking for or had ideas about, you know, our aspirations, and Ducks Newbury bought. It feels now, but I think it felt then like the ideal novel for us.
So I had seen David at the London Book Fair in 2018, and this is before he sent the manuscript to us, and he was really like, I've got this book and it's bonkers and brilliant and I know you will love it. And then I didn't hear from him again until the July, and he gave me a ring and said, I'm sending it through. And that was that, really, wasn't it?
Yeah. So
with not much of a description, actually. So it just kind of came to us, this, you know, marvelous thing.
And Ellie started reading it and started saying, wow, this is incredible. And I think she explained a bit about it to me, you know, the one sentence thing, which I found confusing.
Yeah, until... Sam is the nomad and I'm like the wild yes person. So you have to picture these conversations yeah. in Sam's study.
I want to emphasize though, I was never a no. You know, once I started reading it, a few pages behind Ellie, so she was starting to get really excited and then yeah. would pass on bits to me. And then we were both in, and you get this really exciting thing where a book starts really speaking to you. It's almost... You know, it's the cliche, of course, is the hairs in the back of your neck go up. But like, I think they kind of do. And with a 1,000-page book, it's just maintaining that feeling throughout it is just incredible. And yeah. you know, once you start enjoying a book as a publisher, you just hope and hope that it keeps going until the end. And of course, Ducks did, even though it's a long time until you get to that end.
It was, I do remember very vividly, I think I'd read 30 pages and we really wanted a book to get excited about. So about 30 pages in, I went through to Sam's study and said, this is it, this is the one. So I think we knew quite quickly. And I do also, I think I rang David up and he said, he's very mild-mannered. He said, well, you know, take a month. And I was so excited by then that I was, I don't need a month. give me a week. So, yeah.
He sent it to Gally Becker, and within about a week, well, they were very enthusiastic. And I it seems like about a week later, they were, and we were talking about publishing it with them. And that was exciting.
I think the thing is, you know, it's not a gimmick. It's not a trick, and
it's with absolute intent.
Yeah, it's a way of expressing this woman's inner life. So that's what's important. I think that's what's important as you're reading it. It's not, you know, it's not the fact that it's a single sentence. That's kind of by the by. It's what the book is saying and doing and the rhythm
yeah,
of it.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's important to say that it's kind of it works on, so it's this kind of ideal coupling of form and content, really, and on two different levels. I mean, one, Ducks New Report is a state of the nation book. It's very much talking and distressed about Trump's America and environmental devastation within that. And two, it's really about a housewife and a woman who is kind of working hard to make ends meet to look after her family. And I think the form, so one, the never-ending sentence, and two, the length of the book, is really mimicking America, which is roiling, which is massive, which never stops. But it's also mimicking the maternal load, which is also roiling and massive and never stops. I really think it's extraordinary.
As I mentioned at the beginning, this novel wasn't just a literary challenge, its size presented a very practical challenge, beginning with the invisible art of typesetting, a task handed to Alex Billington.
The typesetting, for instance, our typesetter had to essentially crack InDesign, the program that an awful lot of typesetters use to get the words flowing on the page.
So he hacked the programming.
Yeah, he had to rewrite bits of the code to get it to take this really long flowing sentence, because normally, you know, you have page breaks and paragraph breaks that makes it easier for you to move things around on the page. But that's really not an option on Ducks. And, you know, the sheer size of it as well. So he had to do a lot of, to me, it seems like wizardry. Like, typesetting always seems like wizardry to me anyway. Making things look good on the page is one of the great, almost invisible arts of publishing. Because, of course, if typesetting is well done, you hardly notice it. You notice that it looks nice and then kind of forget about it and sink into the book. And Alex Billington, our wonderful typesetter, in fact, one of the things he always says is that typesetting should be invisible if it's done well. So he did this amazing, amazing work on Ducks to make it look beautiful.
InDesign, which is the tool that most typesetters use these days, It usually tries to sort of make a paragraph look nice on the page by comparing it to other lines, and it has an algorithm in the background saying, you know, we think this looks good, basically. But it's not really used to there being a single paragraph that goes on for a good 1,000 pages. So, and that broke it pretty much. So there's quite a lot of sort of poking around on forums, and, you know, just literally sort of putting Lucy's book into InDesign, it just broke it many, many times. So, which I think she might be rather pleased with, actually. But I like the fact that words can break it. So, after a while, it involved a bit of just some sort of tweaking some weird settings and trying some unusual features and yada yada. But I think one of the bigger, one of the hardest problems I think we were trying to face was how to present it to someone in a way that's actually, you know, as readable as we can get it. We wanted to make it as easy as possible and people not to notice the setting basically as much as possible, so they don't get distracted on the page. Aside from the technical issues of it just being fully broken over and over again by the first round, then that was the other big challenge. But changing a single word, once it's been sort of fixed down on the page, obviously changes potentially the whole rest of the book, because, you know, if you add a line, then the whole book changes by a line, for example. So that also presented some challenges, as Lucy is a bit of a self-confessed tinkerer, I think, with manuscripts.
I mean, editing Lucy is great, and she's very receptive to editorial and takes the things you say very seriously, and it feels like a really good back and forth process. And you get the really exciting thing where you suggest something to her, but then she comes back with something far better than you could ever imagine, which a lot of our writers do, and it's so exciting.
And your understanding of what the book is deepens as you're doing that.
And I suppose, but one of the, is it a price? I don't know. One of the things about her genius is that she's always trying to make her work better and going over the, I was going to say the sentences, but I suppose in Duck's case, it's mainly the sentence, going over things again and again and perfecting them and pushing them that little bit further. So between the, one of, you know, we thought we'd pretty much finished editorial until we got an email from Lucy, and it was one of those emails we were talking about that are hilariously funny, and it was Ellie that was reading it, so maybe you should take over, Ellie.
Well, it was just this long, wonderful email from Lucy, full of interesting things, and sending through what was the final draft. And halfway through the email was just a little sentence saying, "Oh, and oops, I added 30,000 words."
So we had to take that on board, and the thing about it was they were good words.
Yeah. So it didn't, you know, if you're going to print a 750-page book, why wouldn't you print a 1,000-page book? You know, I mean, they're both works of genius. So
yeah.
It was just fine.
So yeah, we went over them, and they made it even better. So in they went, and
I got the first email saying, sort of a warning shot saying, heads up, this enormous book is coming your way, and that was, I think I just checked yesterday, that was I think 340,000 words. And then when I reset it using the template I'd kind of figured out originally, I was like, there's something wrong. Like, I just do not know what's going on. Because now it was like 840 pages, and now it's like over 1,000. And then they're, oh, yeah, Lucy added a bit. So I think it was maybe 80,000 words. So, yeah, that's a whole novel.
I didn't add a chunk later. This 30,000 words I added, it was all over the place. There were little bits added here and there. It was just an editorial effort near the end. And there were more things to add, so I had to add them.
And then it got to the printing. And in the end, we brought on extra help for that, an amazing production consultant called Jeff Barlow, because actually, as it turned out, even the width of the spine is 54 millimetres. There's immediately only three printers in Britain that can do it, and because it breaks the bindery. And you can only do it with a very specific, very few types of paper. So it's to do with getting a paper which isn't see-through but is also really light and really thin. And it was complicated. It was a wild journey, basically. But Jeff helped us enormously. But in the end, we managed it, but then had to reprint very quickly. So our first print run was several thousand books, which we thought was a lot for a 1,000-page novel. But we sold out very quickly because it quickly garnered attention. And actually, when we went back to reprint it, we were told that we had literally used up all of the paper in Europe. I didn't believe them. I was like, well, okay, but, you know, is it really 6 weeks until we get that paper? And they were like, you don't understand us. We have to chop the trees down. So there were all sorts of shenanigans, basically.
These were the challenges of creating the physical book, but imagine being the actress charged with narrating the audiobook. Now, I've narrated audiobooks in my time, and they are exhausting to do, but none of them ever came close to the length of Ducks. I asked narrator Stephanie Ellen how on earth she approached this mammoth task.
The finished length, I just looked it up so I can tell you exactly, 45 hours, 34 minutes. And I recorded it in lots of three-hour sessions. It was initially recorded for the charity, the RNIB, Royal National Institute for Blind People, and then later the recording was bought commercially by WF House. So I was just looking earlier and I wrote this down, 24 three-hour sessions. So it was 72 hours to record. But then, of course, you know how that is. In terms of what it actually worked out to be, it was 45 hours, 34 minutes. So not bad. If I'd been self-recording, as during the pandemic, so many voice artists are self-recording, it would have taken a lot longer, believe me, because I tend to, that's probably what's good about it. When I'm doing it on my own, I tend to go over and over my performance until I get exactly what I want, which takes ages, right? But if you're working with a producer, they're on the clock. As long as you don't mispronounce words, they're good to go. So, yeah, that was an interesting thing for me about recording this is, so if you're doing, you know, like a 200, 300-page audiobook, you have plenty of time in a way to work out your performance. You know, this is where they cry, this is where they get angry, etc. But in such a huge book and the way it's written, you can't really prepare for it because it's stream of consciousness. So suddenly you realize, because she doesn't say, now I am going to get angry. It just becomes clear by suddenly what she's talking about that she is actually quite angry. So it all happens quite spontaneously. And it was probably the least planned performance I've ever done because in a way you couldn't map it all out. There was just too much. So I think that helped it be spontaneous, hopefully. The speed of the thought, you know, when you're caught up in the stream of consciousness of it all, it really was like flowing water. It went from like tiny little droplets. A lot of it will be like in the midst of her thoughts, you know, she's, as we often do, planning what she's going to have for dinner or what ingredients she needs to get because she has a home bakery and she'll be going baking powder, raisins, cherries, and then she'll launch into some incredible list of horrible massacres that happened to the Native American population in the U.S. 200 years ago. And then that will segue into some lines from some classic American films she was watching as she was baking a tartin. And it's just such a collage. But you really start noticing and realizing how much that really does happen in one's thoughts, that just some word that rhymes with another word will springboard you into a whole different level of thought, all combined, you know, the petty, the profound, laughing, crying, getting angry, and just how quickly we switch and then responding to things that are happening. And she doesn't say, oh, now I'm talking to the children, as you don't in your thoughts. So you gradually realize, why is she saying that? Oh, now she's talking to her children. Now she's driving. Now she's in bed. It was sort of like somehow being parachuted into someone else's mind, really quite extraordinary. It really did stay with me because I think she does such an amazing job of recreating how people actually think that, and like looking as you're reading it, because of course it takes longer to actually read it out loud than it takes for thought to happen, because thought is very quick. And so just that lag, you're able to work out, why is she thinking of that now? And why does that come to mind? And so in a way, I think it helped me sort of understand my own thought processes better after that. I didn't dismiss them so much as, why am I always randomly thinking all these strange things? I was able to sort of work out the connections, which happen so quickly in real time, you can't follow them. But there are more links than we think, I believe.
A sense there of some of the appeal of this incredible book, but how does a bookseller entice a potential reader to take on this beast? We hear now from two fans who relish the opportunity. First, Aaron Miles from Waterstones in Salisbury, and then Rob Werner Jeffries, manager of the shop in Farnham.
And when it arrived, I just kind of laughed. The size of the proof itself, just, you know, kind of height-wise and also kind of page number-wise, just kind of laughing, going, when am I going to read this? For some reason, decided that it would be the perfect time during my first Chalk Valley History Festival to read it. I literally sat behind the book tent in like searing 30-degree heat, about 4 metres away from a portaloo on a little crate, flipping through the pages and eating warm ham sandwiches. I wanted to spend as much time as I possibly could with Duck's Newburyport. It didn't take me long to get the flow. As far as kind of one-sentence novels go, it was surprisingly easy to read. I put it kind of front and centre on our table. The moment you come in the front door, that'll be pretty much the first book you see. It's obviously very difficult not to notice because of the size of it, but also the kind of clear blue cover. If I saw people have it in their hand, you know, automatically beeline for them and say, I've read that, it's brilliant. If you want a challenge, I highly recommend it. It's incredibly satisfying once you get through it. I guess playing on kind of people's egos, perhaps, of kind of like, you know, people like to be able to say they can read certain kinds of books at times. And some of those books aren't actually, in many ways, sometimes aren't worth reading. But Duck's Newburyport, I think, wholeheartedly is. But and I think my first line to customers who were looking at it would literally be, it's really, really good. It's 1,000 pages, but it is one sentence. And you know, they'd kind of balk and go, what? Really? How do you read that? And I'm like, it's actually really easy to read. You get through it really quickly because there are no natural stopping points. You can kind of just say to yourself, one more page.
Well, I've been a big fan of Lucy Ellman, and it's probably about 20 years ago now that I first picked up, just idly picked up, a proof copy of Dot in the Universe. It's taken by the cover. I do think that you can judge books by the cover. And it just was odd looking, and I thought, I'll give it a try on the train. And started reading it, and within moments, you're just into this world of quantum physics and murderous tea cozy fetishes and seaside towns in the winter and buggered begonias, and it just swept me away, and I was hooting with laughter, which is an embarrassing thing when you're on the train. It was the book that I've probably pushed into most people's hands over the years, and so by the time we get to Duck's Newburyport, you know, she's one of those writers who, working in the book trade, I will periodically be on the lookout for particular writers to see if they've got any books coming. And the years would roll by. And suddenly there was Lucy Ellman's name and this book, Duck's Newburyport, with a new publisher. I didn't know anything about it. And then I pre-ordered it. And then I saw the page count and I thought, oh my God. I thought, right, I'm going to go for it. I'm diving in. And I dived in. And once you do, you are completely in that book. It is like being plugged into a character's neural pathways. I thought it was fantastic. I think perhaps it's one of those books that looks terribly unassuming. When you look at Duck's Newburyport, it looks very sedate. It's this sort of plain blue cover with a little logo on. And so it really looks like literary fiction with a capital L. And when you see the page count, I think that would be terribly off-putting for people. So it was a question of getting these people and saying, you need to read this writer because, and my own kind of go-to comparisons for Lucy Ellman would be Nora Ephron, Jermaine Greer, Alice Munro, Joan Rivers, David Sedaris, you know, just chuck them in a blender and you pretty much get Lucy Ellman. And I say that knowing full well that if she heard me say that, she would hate me. But, you know, I think once you can convince people that you're not reading something which is going to be taxing in any way, in fact, what it's going to do is it's going to just take you on a log flume.
As mentioned previously, Duck's new report found its way onto the Booker Prize lists in 2019. How was that experience for publisher and author?
Well, you got the text. You were in Waterstones, actually, weren't you? In Waterstones, Norwich.
That's right. I'd forgotten about that. Yeah, so I was in a bookshop, true to form, and got, I think it was an answerphone message. I'd missed a call and picked it up and realised it was from the Booker people, which is just tremendously exciting. I think they tell you a day before they tell everyone else. You don't get that much time. You get a little bit of time to...
Not a massive amount. But then you sent me a cryptic message you didn't actually say. So I was like, what is going on? And I had to wait until you got home.
Yeah, so that's just joyful. It was really nice. And it felt like, you know, we'd already got a load of really good reviews as well, which is fantastic. And, you know, one of the things about the book is we've been talking about the work we did, but of course, Lucy worked so extraordinarily hard on it for so long and believed in it when other people didn't believe in it and kept going. And so it just felt so great for her that she was getting the recognition that she really deserved. So. Yeah. It was fantastic getting the long listing, and you know, it felt like the book's journey to immortality was getting another push.
I think that's really important to say, actually. I mean, what we're talking about is a kind of timeline of perhaps 2 years, 18 months before publication, but for Lucy, that was 8 years, you know. Lucy was at her desk every day writing.
So yeah, then we got to call Lucy, and that's great. And It's pretty similar at the shortlist stage. You get the call and it's incredibly exciting. And we were actually in Canada at the time with Lucy's brilliant US publisher, Dan Wells from Biblioasis, a small publisher over there. So we got the call about the shortlisting whilst we were with him in his living room. So I was kind of on the phone and doing the thumbs up, and everyone was jumping around and really excited. So that was great as well.
It was quite a surprise. I'd never expected it. Yes, I guess that's obvious. The actual experience was a little unnerving, I would say. I'm not used to having to dress up and schmooze or anything and get photographed and filmed. And once I had to, for the Booker, I had to go to London for one night in order to film a 2-minute thing for the Booker party. And this was sort of a fiasco. They put champagne in the room for one thing. So I drunk the champagne before I got to the stupid film. I thought it would help, but actually it didn't go too well. And they used it anyway, to my embarrassment. Anyway. It was exhausting too. There were interviews, there were readings. I did get very tired of interviews. It wasn't just the Booker's fault, but there were quite a few for this book, and you just go nuts eventually. Having explained your book 500 times, you don't know who you are or what the book is anymore. And it's discouraging, really. I mean, everyone was very nice to me, but I still found it exhausting. I'm not a performer. I'm a person who likes sitting in a room for 7 years all alone. I think as any art form, it has to speak for itself. I'm not going to be around forever to explain it. it's got to either work or not.
Hmm.
And if it doesn't, then I can't explain it any better anyway. I don't think I can sell it to people if it doesn't work. So what is the point? What is the point of all these conversations?
Well, that's going to be the opening line of this podcast episode.
I mean, every now and then I still get an email. I wish there were more from people who like it. And I've often not written to writers whose books I like, and because I'm shy. But actually, it's a great thing to do. And it's actually easier nowadays than it used to be. And I like getting that kind of letter and writing back. And that's a new pen pal. I'm usually quite impressed by what they think I was doing.
Mm.
And I hope they're right. I mean, I'm not the best judge, really. And I don't like looking at my stuff too objectively anyway. So it's sort of interesting from a distance to see what other people say about it, but it's probably never going to be how I think about it. But nonfiction is really great as an outlet for rage, immediate outlet, and getting your point straight across, I think. Mm. I think it's much less nebulous than fiction, and that's good and bad. I think of my nonfiction as mostly very angry, but some of it isn't that angry, and some of it's just silly. I could go with that now and then. A lot of these were written over the last 10 years or so. So there have been, it didn't all have to pour out in one go. I reworked them all and rethought them all. Mm. And I wrote some new ones too along the way. But it was an accumulation of various problems I have with the world.
That anger that's clear in the nonfiction, but is also present in the fiction too. And I wonder whether the process of writing that must have a cathartic effect for you. But are you writing these things because you would like to see change in the areas that you're writing about? Or is it just about getting it down on the page?
No, there is an activism aspect, but it doesn't take over, I guess. I think I write out my anger until it just amuses me. And then that is catharsis, I guess. It's done. If it's just plain angry, it bores me.
Mm.
But on the other hand, I do believe in many of the weird things I say. And I do want men to give all their money to women, and I want animals to reign supreme, and I want people to stop driving cars, and I'm really quite a totalitarian nut.
Just as in Dux Newburyport, it's very, very funny, but also there's a lot of darkness in it about terrible situations going on in America and in the world. And there's a lot of extremely political essays, and some of which I think people will be surprised. I think there's a lot of ideas that are fascinating. I wouldn't have dared to go this far in my thoughts about some of the things she proposes that would make the world a much better and fairer place. And I think they might indeed prove very controversial. And there's also a lot of essays that are just pure joy, just so funny. There really is kind of something for everyone in a way. As an actor doing audiobooks, you, at a certain level, you know, you want to draw the audience in. So at some level, you always have a certain amount of pleasure or fun in your voice, let's say, right? But some of these essays, she just heard a little fragment of one essay she was doing that I sent her a sample of. And she encouraged me to not be so pleasant in my voice with this essay, that this was truly a very angry essay. And I could really, as far as she was concerned, feel free to let rip and really let some of this anger and like a harsh tone come out. And, you know, women aren't often encouraged to do that, you know, to show real anger, passion, fury in their voice. It often doesn't go down very well, and they learn to be very moderate in their tone, very placating. So it was amazing to be given license to do that.
She is just one of my favorite people in the world. Like, I cannot tell you how much I love Lucy. So we have Zoom drinks with she and her partner once every couple of weeks. And it's just like, I look forward to it so much because it's just a night of fun. But she's brilliant. I mean, she is dedicated. She's absolutely dedicated to writing. She is very... She knows what she wants to do. She's very focused.
Well, every so often I'll hear Ellie roaring with laughter, or she'll be doing, you know, she'll hear me. And it's because we've had an email from Lucy that's just so funny and brilliant. And, you know, these are just her emails. And
then she sends through her genius work.
Yeah. And so it's great. I mean, I suppose one of the things we haven't really spoken about in all of this, we've kind of focused on the seriousness of her intent and the importance of the art, all of which is really true. But the other thing is, you know, she's so funny, and an awful lot of working with her is just joyful because you're laughing and enjoying it. And
yeah, absolutely. And I just, you know, Duck's New Report is a very serious book, and it is a book with intent, but it's also a very funny book. And the same goes for Lucy's essays, as people will soon see.
The essay collection mentioned there is Things Are Against Us, which has just been published by Gallibegger Press. Duck's New Report is, of course, available in that distinctive blue paperback. Huge thanks to Lucy Ellman for speaking to me, to Sam and Ellie at Gallibegger Press, to typesetter Alex Billington and narrator Stephanie Ellen, and to booksellers Erin Miles and Rob Werner Jeffries. We will continue the animal theme in our next episode of How We Made as we discover the inside story of a book that virtually created a new genre of hybrid writing when I speak with Helen MacDonald about H is for Hawk. See you then.